Ecclesiastes chapter 9. Before I read though, I want to point out a word that you find over and over again in Ecclesiastes. And it's a word that in the Hebrew is pronounced Hebel. H-E-B-E-L. So you say it with Hebel. Very good. It's usually translated in English as vanity or vain. Vanity. You've heard it before in Ecclesiastes. But Hebel actually means. Is that how you turn it off?
So, any of that, the word Hebel. It's usually translated as vanity or vain. But in the Hebrew, the actual essence of the word is mist or vapor. Dust in the wind, as the one song goes. When Cain killed Abel, Abel's life was Hebel. In fact, many people think that the name Abel comes from Hebel, a breath, a short life. In the same way, putting too much stock in things that are Hebel in this world or fleeting is a sign of vanity or absurdity. Jesus reminds us, for example, not to put our trust in the treasures of this world, which can be stolen or rot or decay. The things that don't last because they're Hebel. Yet, I think we can go too far with that. While it's not appropriate to put our trust in things that are Hebel, it doesn't mean that we can't enjoy them. And I think that's one of the main themes that the teacher who wrote Ecclesiastes would have for us. A trivial example is a fireworks display. The fireworks that we see are Hebel. They're fleeting. But because they are Hebel, they're to be enjoyed. That's what makes them enjoyable. A sunset over the lake is Hebel. It's fleeting. But that's what makes the sunset so magical. After I tucked my preschool-aged son Isaac into bed one night, I got ready to close the door to the bedroom, and Isaac stops me. Dad, I said, yeah. Dad, I love you. That's Hebel. But that's part of what makes it so precious. I'd like you to keep that idea of Hebel in mind as I read this passage tonight. The New Revised Standard Version will translate it vain, but I'm going to use the word fleeting instead. So the reading of the word of the Lord. Go eat your bread with enjoyment and drink your wine with merry heart, for God has long ago approved what you do. Let your garments always be white. Do not let oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your fleeting life that you are given under the sun, because that is your position and your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do with your might. For there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going. Again I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to the skillful, but time and chance happen to them all. For no one can anticipate the time of disaster. Like fish taken in a cruel net, and like birds caught in a snare, so mortals are snared at a time of calamity when it suddenly falls upon them. This is the word of the Lord. Amen. A while ago, in a doctor's office, I came across this little article that kind of piqued my interest. There's times, you know, when you're reading things as a pastor or a pastor in training, you know this is going to be sermon material. This is one of them. The article is for parents who are having children that are having problems with sleepwalking. And among the tips that this article offered were the following. You shouldn't yell or make a loud noise to wake up your child. You shouldn't shake your child. The article went on to say that it's important to handle the child's feelings about sleepwalking with care. The article said, for them to suddenly find that they are sleepwalking can be disorienting, uncomfortable, even embarrassing. I think that the teacher who wrote Ecclesiastes knew a thing or two about dreams and about sleepwalking. This ancient teacher would have us understand how we are all prone to carefully, even though subconsciously, build dreams for our lives, for ourselves, and for others. We're always dreaming, aren't we? We're dreaming of the life that might be. We're dreaming of the life that might have been, instead of receiving from God the life that we've been given. When we're young, we dream of what we might do when we grow up. In high school or college, we dream of what jobs we might have, how much money we're going to make. And as soon as we move into the working world, we dream of what our families will be like, who we'll marry, if we'll marry. And those who have children begin to build dreams of who their children are going to become, just as our parents built dreams for each one of us. And as we age, we dream of retirement, but we seldom dream of death. Dreams for ourselves, dreams for our husbands and wives, dreams for our children. The teacher who wrote Ecclesiastes knows that we build for ourselves a world of dreams. But I also suspect that the ancient teacher who wrote Ecclesiastes knew how important it is to awaken from those dreams, to awaken from our sleepwalking that we're prone to. He knew firsthand how at one moment we can seem to be flying high across the world, and then just like that, we find ourselves awake, standing in our pajamas in the middle of the bedroom. For some folks, I think, life seems to pan out pretty much according to their dreams. Their carefully built dream world seems to last for most of their lives, and they leave the world just as they lived it, with their eyes closed. But for most of us, our dreams don't work quite as we'd planned. And we suddenly feel that rough hand of reality grabbing at our shoulder and shaking us awake. Such times of awakening can be disorienting, uncomfortable, even embarrassing. But as the teacher learned and shares with us in this passage, until we awaken from our dreams, we cannot enjoy and embrace the reality that God has given us. A year or so ago, the phone rang as our family was finishing up a Sunday dinner. It was Doug, an old friend of mine who I used to go bicycling with, and I hadn't heard from Doug in a couple of years. My friend was always competitive, a very driven individual, hardworking kind of guy, and in the years that I'd known him, I never detected he was particularly spiritual, that he had much interest in matters of faith. As we chatted on the phone, he caught up on old times and he was asking me how my work was going. And I swallowed hard and I said, Doug, I've given up my partnership with the law firm and I'm taking classes at seminary. I plan to go into ministry. And I braced myself for what response might be coming. And then Doug told me that he respected my decision, even admired it. Well, that's kind of interesting, I thought to myself. Then he told me how much fun he'd recently had working with junior high school kids in the youth group at his church that he'd joined. So you're a youth group worker, I said to him, trying to hold back my sense of surprise. What's going on there? I said to myself. But I didn't have to wait long for an answer. Yeah, he said calmly. He said, since our newborn daughter was diagnosed with bone cancer, he says, I really started looking at life differently. And suddenly it all made sense to me. Doug had been awoken from his dreams of success, his dreams about life, his dreams for his daughter. Doug was a sleepwalker no more. My friend and I next ran into each other. A couple months later, Liz and I were in the hospital. Our son Isaac was going through cleft palate surgery, and he was there. His daughter was being checked for recurrence of any cancer in her blood. He was downstairs in the cafeteria where I met him, and we were grabbing a bite to eat. As we sat and ate and talked, Doug told me about having gone through this ordeal with his daughter's cancer and how it had changed him. It led him to see how little control that he had over his daughter's life, much less her health. Watching his own daughter go through chemotherapy was heart-wrenching, he told me, but it forced him to rely upon God more than he ever had in the past. I have a hunch that it was the first time in his life that he realized so clearly that his future and his daughter's future was not dependent upon his professional prowess or his competitive drive or his ability to turn a dollar. Doug's spiritual eyes had been opened. He saw the true reality that his daughter's life was a gift from God, a Hebel gift, but a gift nonetheless. And that her life and her continued health depended entirely upon God's mysterious grace. And from there, I think Doug began to see how all of life hinges upon God's mysterious grace, and how all of life can be so Hebel. As he told me this, about what he'd learned about accepting life as a gift, I could imagine that bearded little scribe, that little teacher who wrote Ecclesiastes, sitting beside us in one of the chairs, smiling softly and nodding his head in agreement. Again, I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor favor to the skillful, but time and chance happen to them all. At one moment we soar through the air free as a bird, then suddenly we're caught in a snare and we're falling to the ground, unable to escape certain disaster. And the questions flood our minds. Why me? Why her? Why this? Why now? The poignancy of the teacher's observations doesn't leave us very easy. It's the same poignancy that tears at us when we hear a mourner cry out, "It's just not fair." A couple of years ago, I met a man named Jim, who was in his 80s. Jim walks with a limp and the help of a walker, but he has a glint in his eyes and a ready smile. As I got to know Jim, he reminisced about his 50 years of marriage to Clara and the days when they were healthy and raising their kids together. He talked about how he and Clara had never spent a single night apart for the entire 50 years of their marriage. Not a single night apart, I thought. Isn't that amazing? Then he told me about Clara's diagnosis with Alzheimer's. His voice became quieter and more sober as he recounted the slow, relentless eroding of her memory. I learned how the world gradually shrunk along with her mind. He told me about how Clara gradually gave up hobbies, gave up social activities, gave up going to church because she just couldn't remember enough to do it anymore. They finally gave up their house and moved to an apartment. Just too many ways for her to hurt herself, Jim said to me. And eventually their entire world spanned a little more than this one-bedroom apartment, which Jim had to keep locked from the inside so Clara wouldn't let herself out at night. When he finally broke his hip trying to care for her, the kid sent him to the hospital and her to an Alzheimer's unit. Eventually, Jim was transferred to a retirement home next door to the nursing home that cares for the Alzheimer's patients. Jim tried to get his kids to let them move back into the apartment, but his kids probably wisely said no. He tried to get the nursing home to let Clara move in with him in his retirement home apartment. And they said no. Jim and Clara, who'd never spent a night apart in 50 years of marriage, now lived in separate beds, in separate buildings, and they would do so for the rest of their lives. So every morning after breakfast, Jim got his walker, and he strolled that little thing across two parking lots to go over and visit Clara each day. Freezing cold, snow, sleet, or blazing hot, it didn't make a difference. He always made it over there. Jim was the only person Clara recognized, and she craved his companionship. And every evening as he got ready to go back to his retirement unit, Clara would become anxious and beg him to stay. He'd tell her, "It's okay, I'll come back after dinner." And he told me it broke his heart to have to lie to her like that, but it's the only thing that would calm her down. And each night he'd go back to his retirement home, he'd eat his dinner, and he'd go upstairs. And he'd spend the night trying to sleep, but at the same time praying that God would not let Clara drift any farther out to sea, out so far that she wouldn't even recognize him anymore. For no one can anticipate the time of disaster. Like fish taken in a cruel net, and like the birds caught in a snare, so mortals are snared at a time of calamity when it suddenly falls upon them. Compelled by Jim's experience, the depth of his grief and the shattering of his dreams, I asked him about his faith, and he told me without hesitation that these struggles have only increased his reliance on God. Jim knows that he must now trust in a wisdom and a power that's beyond his understanding and beyond his control. He's forced to surrender his future to God. He's forced to surrender to God his wife's future, which strangely liberated him to enjoy his wife from moment to moment. The dreams Jim and Clara built for their retirement never included Alzheimer's. It never included living their final years apart from each other. And your dreams for retirement and mine don't include such nightmares either. But this teacher in Ecclesiastes reminds us that our dreams are just that. They're our dreams. And the teacher reminds us that reality can shake us awake. We find ourselves sitting up in bed at 3 a.m, sweat soaking through our sheets. The Apostle James understood the words of the scribe when he wrote, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we'll go to such and such a town and spend a year there doing business and making money. You do not even know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life?" James writes. "You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes." We are Hebel. A while back, I had lunch with an attorney friend of mine. My friend paid his own way through college. He paid his own way through law school. He got good grades, got a good job in a law firm, had a wife, 2 kids, a real go-getter. After a few minutes of pleasantries during lunch, I asked him about how his 2 kids were doing in college, and he told me all about his oldest daughter and how she'd gone to a prestigious school and she was getting great grades and she was expecting to graduate any time now. You could tell she was ready to live the dream that he had prepared for her. "And your son?" I asked. "Brian," he said, "I just don't know what to do with him. I've paid for his first 2 years at State. Now this past Sunday he calls and he tells me that he wants to move with his girlfriend to Georgia. He wants to withdraw from school." "Georgia, Brian, Georgia. He's got no plans. Just move out and see what happens." My friend's frustration was obvious. "He's wasting his life, Brian. He lacks ambition. He's got no goals. He doesn't seem to care about anyone but himself. No matter what I say to him, he just won't listen." So I bite my lip and I grit my teeth, and that's all I can do about it. And again I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. But time and chance happened to us all. As we sat and we talked, I wanted to tell him that his son will always be beyond his control, but never beyond his love for him. Just as in many ways, we're beyond God's control, but never beyond God's love for us. I wanted to tell him what my friends Doug and Jim had learned, and what I've been trying to learn for many years now, that the way to life leads through suffering and loss and grief. Not by living in a dream that denies its reality. I could have said all this to him, but he wouldn't have heard it. He was still sleepwalking. He was still building dreams of what his children could be or should be. But the problem is that with each day of his continued dream building for his would-be, could-be kids, he was forfeiting his enjoyment of the gift of the son that God had given him. Doug's daughter, Jim's wife, my friend's son, they are so fleeting, so hebel. We're not to put our trust in them, but we are to enjoy them. For it's their very hebelness that makes them so precious. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.